Thank you. Well, thank you for the opportunity to be with you again. Well, I was really pleased to get this question because last term, those of you who are here last term will know that I was speaking on Jesus' crucifixion and death. And so got to the bit where he was buried and I wanted to go on because this is so much more exciting. And so now I get the chance to do the sequel. So thank you for that. Now, when someone asks a question, and this was the question that was given to me, how on earth did Jesus rise from the dead? I like to sort of try and figure out what's behind the question. And it's not working. Oh, yes, it is. And as I was reflecting on it, I thought, well, there are a number of ways you could sort of interpret this question. It could be, how on earth did Jesus rise from the dead? Some sort of exclamation of, you know, can you really believe that that's true this day and age? So that's one way of thinking about the question. Perhaps that was the intent behind, I don't know if the person who asked the question is here this evening. If so, they'll set me straight at the end, no doubt. Another way of, but I was thinking, well, another way you could look at this is you could say, well, it's true, but when Jesus was raised from the dead, you know, how was he? What was his resurrected existence like? How was that? Could possibly be another interpretation. For the physicists among us, it could be, well, I accept that Jesus rose from the dead, but what was the process and the mechanism by which that actually happened? Well, I'm going to focus on the first bit, first question today. However, I don't have 100 slides as Keith had last week. I do have almost 60, so there's no way we'll get through everything. But we'll see where we go. But I will attempt at least to look at these two if we have time. If not, we'll do it after we've finished. First thing I want to say, and Keith alluded to this last week, is that this is really, a critical and foundational issue for us. This is Paul writing his letter to the Corinthian church, in which he says, "This what he's got is of first importance," he said. And what's the message? That Christ died, that Christ was buried, that he was raised, and that he was seen. Dead, buried, raised, and seen. So we're going to look at that. So Paul says it's of first importance. And he goes on a few verses later to say that if Christ had not been raised from the dead, our preaching is useless, and so is our faith. So this is a really important issue that we need to get our heads around, which is why I want to spend most of the time on that first question. Can we really believe that this is true? The resurrection of Jesus was also a major theme of the apostles' original preaching and teaching. Just a few examples, all from the book of Acts, of where they were actually giving testimony and witness and speaking about Jesus being raised from the dead, reinforcing, as I guess we all know here today, that it really is foundational and crucial. So I'm going to be following a fairly standard line of reasoning. Some of you may have heard this before. William Lane Craig, I think, spoke on it in the Guildhall not that long ago. Was it last year or was it the year before? I can't remember. But essentially reflecting on three, I've called them historical assertions or facts. Some would say these are facts, but I'm sort of allowing for we may stand on, you know, different parts of the spectrum here as we look at these things. But I want to say three historical assertions or facts. One is that the tomb in which Jesus' body was placed was found to be empty. His body was gone. The second is that he appeared to many people after his death. And the third topic, fact, issue, assertion I want to explore is the question of the origin of Christian belief in the resurrection. Where did that come from if it wasn't actually for the fact of the resurrection? Okay. The fact of the empty tomb is supported by quite a number of different strands of evidence, and I've listed them here. We want to think about the historical reliability of the story itself. Can we trust the story? How accurate is it? We'll look at Paul's testimony. We've already seen some of Paul's writing. We'll look at the origins of the story and the age of the story, thinking a little bit about the style of the story, a bit of textual criticism there, thinking about the fact that it was first discovered by a group of women, which I think is a significant fact, and also looking at some of the very early attempts to discredit this story, all supporting the fact that the tomb was indeed empty. So the first issue is, how reliable are the stories that we see in the Gospels? If the burial accounts that we read there are accurate, then the site of Jesus' grave was known to people in Jerusalem. Jesus was a well-known figure. There's a lot of very specific detail about the site of the tomb. So it was known to both Jews, and I guess they weren't Christians at the time, but they were early followers of Jesus. If Jesus' body hadn't actually gone from the tomb, the burial site, then if the body was still there, then clearly the disciples had no reason to believe that Jesus had been raised from the dead. Even if they had believed that Jesus had been raised, it's hard to see how they could have gained any following. The Jewish authorities would also know where the tomb was. After all, they had guards placed on it. So it would have been very easy for them to produce a pile of bones to discredit the rumour that was circulating in Jerusalem that the body had actually gone from the tomb. So the very facts of the story itself really support the reliability of that story. The second is Paul's testimony. We saw this earlier, Paul saying that he'd received this story, a part of a tradition that was circulating in the early church, that he was buried and that he was raised on the third day. As we look at some of the objections to some of these arguments later, we could say, well, Paul just meant he was buried, he was raised, it was a sort of spiritual resurrection. But as we'll see later, that really doesn't fit what Jewish writers would have meant when they say that someone was raised from the dead. We'll come back to that later, so hold that thought. The key thing about Paul's testimony is that it would appear to be very early. It's not a story that's had time to develop. It's not like a bunch of people have sat around saying, how can we rationalise what's been going on? 1 Corinthians probably dated to sometime in the mid-AD 50s. But Paul is clearly citing something that he has received much earlier. Now, we know that Paul was in Jerusalem around about AD 33, would have met with Peter and the other apostles. And so many historical commentators think it's quite likely that Paul picked up that account round about that time, which is a mere 3-4 years after the events which are being described. So it's not a story that someone has had time to sit down and figure out theologically. It's much more likely to be a story that actually reflects the events that had happened, as it actually purports and claims to be. The age of the story is also supported by analysis of the text itself. There is general consensus that Mark's Gospel is probably the oldest of the Gospel accounts. There is a range of dates assigned to Mark's Gospel, many putting it probably just a few years before AD 70, but there is increasing evidence that it could date to as early as AD 46, 47. Analysis and literary analysis of the Gospel itself points to a much earlier source on which it's based, the so-called pre-Markan, or at least this part of Mark's Gospel, the pre-Markan passion story. And that has a number of factors which, again, indicate that it was written at the time. So, for example, the story never actually gives a name to the high priest in Jerusalem. It's a bit like saying the president of the United States. We wouldn't name him. We know who he is all too well. And it's the same sort of thing that's going on here. The figure isn't named. If it was written much later, then you would have to name him because your audience wouldn't know who you were talking about otherwise. So there are aspects of the story that imply, again, this is very early. And when we come to think about myth and legend a little later, you'll see this is really important. It points to the fact the story is early. It hasn't had time to develop or be developed in a sophisticated way. It's simply reflecting the facts as they were stated. Got there in the end. Another aspect that points to the story being an accurate reflection of the facts is the style of the writing. It's, as we're going to see in a minute, it's stark and it's quite minimalist in its approach to describing what's happened. If it had been developed over a number of years, if it had been developed to make a theological point, as many commentators say, you can't trust the Gospels, they were written to make particular theological points, then it would have more characteristic of myth and legend. And in this aspect, it's instructive to compare it with what we might call the apocryphal Gospels, those that date to much later, the second century AD. So here's an example. Here's Mark, chapter 16. And it is, as I said, it's a very stark story. The woman comes to the tomb. She's going to apply these spices to anoint Jesus' body. So obviously she expected to find a body there when she got there. Otherwise she wouldn't have carried all those spices with her. She finds the tomb empty. She's surprised, trembling and bewildered, doesn't know what to do. It's a stark, very basic story. Compare that with this account from the Gospel of Peter. This is much more Hollywood in style. You know, there was a great voice in the heaven, and the heavens opened, and two men descended from thence with great light and approached the tomb. As they approached the tomb, the stone rolled away. And the young men went into the tomb and they came out. Three men came out and a cross was following them. What's that about? And the two men reached into heaven, but the head of him was already over the heaven. You know, it's just not, it just doesn't read like a factual historical account, whereas the original gospel stories do. They have all the hallmarks of being historical accounts. The style of writing, the closeness to the original events all point to these being historical accounts. Another fact, according to the accounts, this tomb was first discovered by a group of women. And in that culture, at that time, women had a lower social standing than men. Their testimony wasn't regarded in court. If you're going to make the story up, you wouldn't have women finding the tomb. Again, it points to the fact that it is extremely unlikely that this story would have been made up. Final one, and then we'll look at the resurrection appearances, is that there is no evidence, and I know that lack of evidence isn't, absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence, but we would expect at least some suggestion of an attempt by the authorities who had so much to gain, denying the fact that the tomb was empty. But the earliest response seems to actually to be to try and come up with an explanation for why the tomb was empty. So that those who had an interest in demonstrating that the tomb wasn't empty actually had more or less admitted that it was empty. And in a later gospel, in Matthew's gospel, we find there an attempt to try and refute this argument that the disciples had actually stolen the body away. And we'll come back to that. But again, the presupposition of both those who would want to support the idea of resurrection and those who would want to deny it was that there's no body, and so something has to account for the lack of a body and the empty tomb. That's, we could spend ages just on the empty tomb, but those are the sort of key pointers and key arguments that we would use to explain or point to the fact of an empty tomb. This is debated to some extent how widely recognized it is as a fact. There are still some New Testament scholars who would argue against this, but many, and in his book Reasonable Faith, William Lane Craig actually lists these 28 scholars that Kramer lists, and also adds a further 16, so a total of 44 scholars there who would actually say this is the best explanation of what's going on here. So let's move on and think about the second leg on this three-legged stool, the resurrection appearances. So we read in Scripture that on many occasions and in many varying and different circumstances, different groups and individuals experienced appearances of Jesus being alive. These are just a few that I gleaned from the New Testament. And it says, and as you can see from the variety here, some are to individuals, some are to small groups of people, some are to large assemblies. There's one to 500 disciples that Paul alludes to in 1 Corinthians 15. Jesus appears to believers and unbelievers. We'll look at that in a moment. Women and men, in public and in private. There's no consistency to the appearance. It's across the board in so many different ways. Incidentally, it's also worth noting that if you look at the non-Christian writings of the times of the Roman or Jewish histories, they are very clear in saying that the Christians believed fervently that they had seen Jesus. So you have to explain why they believe so strongly that they had seen him as well. So it's documented there. So multiple independent attestations in the gospel accounts. We looked last time when we were looking at the arguments for Jesus' death and the reliability of the gospel accounts there at the sort of criteria that historians and scholars apply when looking at historical records. And one of them is, do we have multiple stories which are sort of independent and sort of support one another? And we know from study of the Gospels that they are supported by multiple underlying sources. And actually, in many places in the Gospels, there's strong evidence that the writers knew one another's work. There's sort of borrowing, there's common themes that are happening, so these common traditions that are underpinning that. When you get to the resurrection story, something quite interesting happens. They seem much more independent in their accounts, and it's a bit like witnesses at trial. And my wife sits as a magistrate here in Southampton, so she's often hear stories on this. You get witnesses, and they have quite different views of the details of what happens in a particular incident, but the underlying facts are often quite consistent, and that's what you see here in these different resurrection stories in the Gospels. Was it one woman? Was it two women? Who was there first? What was the sequence or order of events that were happening? They differ because people's memories of these things are different. But the key central point of all their stories, that the tomb was empty, that the body was gone, that the stone was rolled away, are all consistent, a strong grip on that central point. So again, that points to the fact that these stories aren't fabricated. If you're going to sit down and make the strongest possible case, you'd get your facts straight, wouldn't you? And that's often a sign in trials, isn't it? If all the witnesses agree on all the details, you know there's been some collaboration on the stories before they get to court. There are a number of these resurrection appearances that have a strong earmark of historicity in what's going on in there. We know from reading the Gospels earlier that the brothers of Jesus, his younger brothers, didn't really believe in him during his lifetime. There are many little incidents where they either think he's out of his mind, or they tell him to go off down to Jerusalem from Galilee and, you know, go and perform your miracles in public where everyone can see them, they say in John 7. And if, you know, Jesus' family had been faithful followers of Jesus all along, there's no reason the gospel writers would make out that they weren't. And yet, after Jesus' death, certainly James and Jude probably became very active in the early Christian church. James was considered an apostle and rose up to leadership. The first century Jewish historian Josephus tells us that James was martyred for his faith. So the question is, what would it take you, those of you who have brothers, what would it take you to convince your brother that your brother who'd been killed was the risen Lord, such that you'd be ready to die for that? The brother you dismissed, what brings about that change? And why would someone who didn't really believe in Jesus make up a story about seeing him after his death? So the third leg on the stool, then, is this whole question of where did this belief in the resurrection of Jesus come from? Can we trace it back to Jewish thought? Can we trace it somewhere else? What caused this belief to come about? And if it was simply something they fabricated, if it was wishful thinking, if it was a hallucination, why did it take the shape or form that it did? Remember the context. Jesus and his disciples were grounded in the beliefs and traditions of first century Judaism. In the first century AD, people weren't really that different from they are today. There were many different beliefs about and speculations about what happens after we die. And it's important to grasp the idea that the word resurrection, as used in Christian literature and Jewish literature, refers to something very specific. It's not any of these options about what happens to our bodies after we die, but it's a very specific one. It's a new bodily existence. It's not some spiritual thing. It's not sitting around on in some sort of cloud-like existence separated from our bodies. It's not an apparition or a ghostly appearance. We know that they had a language for these things. In Acts 12, we read of Peter out of prison. He's knocking at the door. The servant girl goes to answer the door, sees Peter, goes and says, "It's his ghost." You know, it's they have a language. She thought that it was simply just a vision, an apparition of Peter there. They also had a language for visions. Stephen was martyred in Acts, he has a vision of Jesus, but the language is very clear to say that's actually very different from a resurrection appearance. So to try and dismiss this as they're just spiritualizing something that has happened is really hard to do because the language is so specific. However, there's another issue here in that the Jewish people were the only ones in the ancient world who believed that God would eventually raise the dead. So there was this tradition and belief in resurrection, at least in certain branches of Judaism, not in all. But they had no notion that God would raise someone, an individual, from the dead in the middle of history. It was something that was going to happen to all righteous people at the end of time. There were some who made claims that individuals might be raised from the dead. One of the most obvious being in Maccabees. 2 Maccabees is one of the apocryphal Old Testament books, the story of the Maccabean uprisings. And the followers of this particular sect, it was a warrior, you know, it was a messianic type sect, but they were trying to bring in the new kingdom by force. It was a revolt that took place in Judea, and their followers devoutly believed that these people killed in battle would be raised from the dead. However, the interesting thing is, although they believed that before they were killed, their followers, no one ever believed that they had actually been raised from the dead after the fact. It's also interesting to note that Jesus only speaks of resurrection explicitly. There are many allusions that he makes to his death and his being raised to life again. But he only explicitly speaks about resurrection once, well, possibly twice if you think of Lazarus. We'll come on to Lazarus later. Which is slightly curious because it was a huge topic of debate between the Pharisees and the Sadducees at the time. And that's where, in Matthew 22, he sort of gets into this debate because they try and drag him into this debate. But he doesn't take the bait. He makes only one very short and cryptic comment on the subject, which is sort of slightly bizarre. Again, if you're making up a story and you really want to bolster this idea of Jesus being raised from the dead, why not have Jesus speaking about it and explaining exactly what's going to happen and how it's going to work and all those sorts of things? Another pointer to the fact it's extremely unlikely these stories were made up. If you compare early Christian belief with the prevalent Jewish belief at the time, there are some other interesting factors about it. As we've noted, in some Jewish traditions believed in a resurrection of the dead, others didn't. But almost all, perhaps one or two notable heretical exceptions, they all believed that their ultimate hope was the resurrection of the body. There was no spectrum of belief such as found in Judaism. Why would that be so if it weren't a well-established fact? It also had a much more precise shape and content to it than anything that would be found in Judaism. And we'll look a little bit later about what Jesus' body was actually like. But if you read the rest of Scripture, it's very clear that it's an act of new creation. It's a body which has already been planned by God. Paul goes on to expand this in 1 Corinthians 15 again, after the bits that we looked at, that it's a new body. God is already preparing these things for us, and Jesus being raised from the dead is the first sign of that. It's not a simple return to the same body as before. As we said, it's very physical. We're not sitting on clouds as some spiritual beings in some sort of unembodied, blissful, eternal existence, but we have physical bodies after the resurrection. But it's also different. It involves transformation. And the other interesting aspect, and again, there's a lot of precision around this, is that the resurrection has been split into two. It's still one theological event. Again, Paul in 1 Corinthians 15 and right at the beginning of Romans talks about this. It's one theological event, but it's two phases, very intricately tied together. First, Jesus has been raised from the dead, but then each of us will be raised from the dead and have a resurrection body. These two things are inseparable. They're separated in time, but theologically they're inseparable. So it's a very different belief. And the question is, if the early Christians made it up, a bunch of fishermen and tax collectors, where did they get these tremendous theological insights from, if not simply from being faced with the resurrected Jesus? Well, one other account says, well, they just borrowed these ideas from pagan beliefs. And there's a whole variety of these that are thrown out. I've just got two here on the slide. Horus is one that is spoken of. In fact, you can go on the internet and find some amazing descriptions of Horus that mirror almost every aspect of Jesus, from his birth through to his crucifixion. They're urban myths. If you actually go and look at the original texts, well, Horus wasn't even reported to have died in most of the Egyptian narratives. There's no crucifixion story. He sort of dies and reborn every day. He's a bit sort of cycles with the sun god. There is, in one account, something that describes Horus' death, but it says he was cast into pieces, cut into pieces, thrown into the water, and later fished out by a crocodile. Doesn't seem to have a lot of resemblance to the story of Jesus being raised from the dead. Mithras, the Mithraic tradition, is another one. But again, if you go and look at the original sources rather than the stuff that's on the internet, you find there's nothing in the original traditions that actually indicated he ever died. And there's nothing that says anything about him being raised from the dead. So it's not likely that he would, that the Christians would have borrowed that as a source for resurrection. Interestingly, some of these Mithraic traditions that talked about him being Mithras being raised from the dead actually date from the second, possibly third century. So actually a bit later, and could have actually borrowed from the Christian traditions. But that's not what you read. So, three-legged stool, three assertions. The tomb was empty. Jesus appeared on multiple occasions in multiple different ways to his early followers and to those who weren't followers. And there is this belief in the resurrection, which the early church used to describe these facts, well-established belief arising early in the history of the church, which doesn't bear any relation to anything that's gone before. So are these assertions facts or not? If we accept them as fact, then we need to consider the most likely reasonable explanation. So, two questions there. Are they facts? What's the best explanation? Well, let's look at some of the common refutations. The tomb wasn't empty. We've touched on some of this already. The earliest story was that Jesus' disciples stole the body, and they just lied about it. They created a hoax, basically. It's the conspiracy theory. Well, is that likely? Here you've got a bunch of people who, even by the admission of those who didn't like the Christians, were by all evidence good, honest people who supported one another. They weren't liars, they weren't cheats, and besides, they'd just been demoralised by the death of their leader. It seems an extremely unlikely story. The women went to the wrong tomb. Well, the Gospels are at pains to say where the tomb was, so if they'd gone to the wrong tomb, that could easily have been pointed out by the Jewish authorities. They didn't. They said they went to the right tomb, but it was empty, so they were trying to explain why it was empty. A theory that had been popular for a while was that Jesus did not die on the cross, he merely swooned. We haven't got time to go into that really now, but there is a lot of medical evidence. People who have actually looked at aspects of crucifixion from a medical standpoint said even if he wasn't dead, and actually Roman executioners were extremely good at their job, and in fact would be under sentence of death themselves if they didn't carry it out properly, and were well practiced at killing people, and Jesus had just had a spear thrust into his side, if he wasn't dead, he was hardly likely to emerge as a glorious resurrected figure. He might have stumbled out. So it's extremely unlikely that he wasn't dead in the first place. And even if he wasn't, then he's not going to be a glorious resurrected Messiah. There's also a theory circulated, well, maybe there wasn't even a tomb in the first place. The whole gospel account is made up. The sort of the unmarked grave theory, that he was taken off the cross and, as any other common criminal would be, just thrown into some ditch by the roadside and buried there. Of course, that's contradicted by the gospel accounts, which, as we said, have facts in them that have a level of detail that really speak against that. It is quite hard to explain why Pilate allowed Joseph of Arimathea to take the body, but why name a prominent figure if that wasn't actually a fact? Second counter-argument is there weren't actually any sightings of a bodily resurrected Jesus. This is the hallucination or visionary approach. We'll look at that again in a moment. Some suggest that, well, maybe Jesus had an identical twin brother who somehow got separated from him at birth, but then later returned to impersonate a risen Christ. I think that one might have been unraveled fairly quickly at the time. And then there's the myth or legend approach. Basically, the Christian church needed an origin story, and so they made this one up. I mean, with the best of intentions, they were trying to rationalise the facts as they saw them. So that's another counter-argument. And then finally, the origin of the Christian belief. Well, we've talked about the borrowing from pagan beliefs, seeing why that might not be true. It could be a rationalisation, a bit like this, of a very traumatic experience. After we've had our coffee break, we'll come and look at... You're going to do some work on this one in a moment, because my voice is going to give up. But before we do that, just quickly run through myths and legends. Myths generally take a long time to develop. I'm quoting Sherwin White here. Not a Christian, but an expert in Roman history, society, and law. He says two full generations. Some argue with him on that one, but it takes time. Mueller says that legend cannot replace fact as long as the eyewitnesses remain alive. You have people who can actually say, well, it didn't actually happen like that. And the Gospels and the New Testament accounts are very clear on saying there are eyewitnesses. Luke says, I've checked the facts. You can go and check the facts with the eyewitnesses. And that's the point. You know, the Gospels, many of these epistles were written very soon after the events. The eyewitnesses were there. Or people that knew the eyewitnesses that were there. So not likely, not really enough time. It's at odds with what the writers themselves are actually saying. You know, they weren't stupid. They knew the difference between mythical and factual eyewitness testimony. There's a lot of work that's been done. You can read Craig Blomberg on the historical reliability of the New Testaments, of the Gospels, historical reliability of the Gospels. They believed they were writing history, and the style of the writing closely corresponds to with what would be historical accounts, biographical accounts of the time. They were asserting there were eyewitnesses of these historical events. And they were also honest enough to report their own difficulty in trying to actually interpret and understand some of these events. The story of the resurrection isn't one where everyone suddenly accepted what was going on. As we've already seen, the women fled in terror from the tomb, and it took a while for people to get their heads around this and actually begin to explain what was really going on. And again, the gospel accounts have careful attention to historical details, and much work has been done to show that where historical details can be validated, they support what's in the Gospels. We already saw the comparison between Mark's Gospel and the Gospel of Peter in the sort of the style of writing in myths and legends. The apocryphal writing seemed to reflect a God who almost works miracles on demand, as it were. For no particular reason, things happen. They're either trivial and they're often extremely spectacular in nature. Whereas the biblical miracles just seem normal and everyday and straightforward, apart from the fact they're miraculous. But the account of how they actually happen, with all the miracles in the Bible, is pretty down to earth. You know, someone spits in someone's eyes or puts mud on their eyes, or Jesus just pour water into the jars and it becomes wine. The tomb's empty. There's no literary flowery around that. And also miracles in the Greek religion, in those myths, are frequently bizarre talking animals, talking birds, trees with humans traveling the world without eating, all sorts of strange things. So the style of myth and legend, very different. We'll take a quick break because we're going to spend a bit of time on this one in a minute. Okay, so I alluded to this a little earlier, that one explanation for what's going on here is that the disciples were simply trying to rationalize in some way a very traumatic experience that they'd just been through. And I think this is one of the more recent lines of argument along this path. Introduces this idea as a psychological condition known as cognitive dissonance reduction, which basically is fancy language for. It's talking about a human tendency to rationalize this sort of discontinuity between the reality that you've just perceived and what your current beliefs were. So the disciples, believe that Jesus was coming to set things right. And yet his ministry had apparently ended in complete failure, his death, in a very shameful and ignominious way. And so they had to sort of try and modify their beliefs in some way and add to them, not rejecting what's happened, but trying to explain that away. And you find that when this happens, and psychologists find that it can actually result in fairly radical rationalizations. And, of course, if you're using this as an argument against the resurrection, say, especially in religious contexts. Why especially in religious contexts, I'm not sure. So here are a couple of examples that are given, and I thought it'd be fun to spend a bit of time. You can have a little discussion about whether you think these are actually reasonable counterexamples. So Sabbatai Zevi was a 17th century Jewish preacher, widely thought to be the long-awaited Jewish Messiah by those who hadn't realized he'd already come. So his followers got really excited by the fact that they thought he was the Messiah, he's the one, and then he converted to Islam, which was a bit of a shock to them. I borrowed these words from someone who was using this as an example. He said, and against all common sense, he said, well, we could debate whether it was against common sense or not. But anyway, instead of killing off the movement, his followers came up with this idea that his conversion was part of some intentional strategy to sort of destroy Islam from within, as it were. And apparently, it still has a few followers today. So that was one example of where belief in a Jewish Messiah got so twisted by a very unexpected event that they sort of twisted the views of it. The second one is this example of this guy Schneerson, more recent, 1990s. He gained a following during a sect of Hasidic Jews who again expected. Thought he was the Jewish Messiah who was going to usher in the end times. However, he died of a stroke in 1994, which sort of put a bit of a stop to that. Did this stop him from believing he was the Messiah? No. Actually, a bit like the Maccabees, perhaps in some sense, they rationalized he would soon return from the dead to usher in the final redemption. To date, that hasn't happened. No one's claimed that's happened. So this one, perhaps the idea of, they're saying there will be a resurrection, is perhaps similar. So a couple of minutes. What do you think? Throw back a bit as sort of parallels to the resurrection story. Are they good counter arguments? Are they good examples to use? What do we think of this cognitive dissonance reduction? Is it a good explanation? Opportunity to falsify. Some of these things, it could, you're hedging your bets because it's something that's not happened yet, so it might still happen. There's no risk, there's no personal risk involved. I mean, remember the early disciples were at risk of being executed themselves for putting across these views. The other thing I'd say is there's actually nothing essentially new. There's no new ideas in these beliefs. And we've already seen that the resurrection, this idea of an individual being raised to life with a physical body, in the sense that Jesus was completely new in this environment as well. So there's nothing new here. And I think the cognitive dissonance reduction, if you think about it, it's a bit like hallucination. So hallucination was one suggestion. The disciples just imagine, people just imagine these appearances or just hallucinated these appearances. But study of hallucination shows that you only hallucinate stuff that's within your worldview and your understanding of the world at the time. The resurrection is actually breaking their previous understanding of the world and introducing ideas and concepts that are substantially new. And in both these cases, there's nothing that's conceptually new in their beliefs. Yeah, they've had to modify their beliefs. So I don't think these work well as arguments.
Yes, you told them what was going to happen in advance, and neither of these two people did.
Jesus told his disciples what was going to happen, and we haven't gone and looked at that in detail. And he was a bit cryptic about a lot of it, but he did tell them on many occasions what was going to happen. You could look at Old Testament prophecy as well. And you can go online and read about the cognitive dissonance reduction if you want. It was fun. I'm going to skip over. Okay, so another question is, can we actually, our main body, in fact really our own body of documentary evidence for the resurrection, the texts that are in the Bible, the empty tomb, and the resurrection appearances, although there are other writings that say the disciples and the followers of Jesus clearly believed that they had these experiences, that they don't go into detail of what those appearances were like. So I think there is a key question here. Can or should we accept the New Testament writings as historical evidence? And we covered this a little bit when we were looking at the crucifixion. So I'm going to skip through this. I'm not going to go through this because we all know this. You could do a whole session on the historicity of the New Testament, which I guess you've done previously. So I want to ask the question: I think we've got a good body of evidence that suggests the facts. The three assertions are three facts. How do we explain those facts? Is the resurrection of Jesus, the fact that Jesus was raised from the dead, a plausible explanation? And is it a better fit than, you see my bias here, than any of the implausible explanations, the naturalistic explanations that have already been offered? A lot of authors cite McCulloch justifying historical descriptions and his seven criteria for testing a hypothesis about historical events. And most of these are fairly well accepted by most people on the gospel accounts. The one where people begin to attack the gospel accounts of the resurrection are really on this one. He says the hypothesis must be less ad hoc than any rival hypotheses, by which he means that we shouldn't bring in new ideas or suppositions about the past which are not already implied to some extent by existing knowledge. We shouldn't add arbitrary things into the mix to try and explain what's going on. Now, we can have a long argument as to whether this is actually valid. We could actually debate what is ad hoc. And in fact, philosophers of science actually find it notoriously difficult to pin down what is ad hoc, don't they, Peter? But also, I'd actually point out that physicists rely on this to some extent anyway. What about quarks and strings and gravitons and multiverses? They're ideas that are introduced in order to develop theories. And it's a perfectly legitimate way of progressing knowledge. You introduce something into the mix which you haven't at the time got physical evidence for. You build a theory around it that allows you to go and try and explore whether that indeed fits the physical reality. So I think there are parallels there. But let's assume that it stands, and we shouldn't introduce too many ad hoc claims. Here's Matthew Ferguson. Matthew Ferguson runs a blog called Adversa Apologetica, in which he takes issue with Christian apologists. And this is from an article he wrote called Knocking Out the Pillars of the Minimum Facts Apologetic, which is this, basically the thing we've just been through, the three facts on the resurrection. And he says, historians cannot make claims with good probability about the past that involve too many unproven ad hoc assumptions. Okay, yeah, we'll accept that. He goes on, so he uses this example of alien abduction. Okay? So people claim they've been abducted by aliens, that these things have occurred in the past. And he says, you know, you have to make many assumptions, such as aliens exist, aliens visit the Earth, aliens take humans away for whatever nefarious purposes they have, and then they bring them back again. And it always seems to happen in Midwest America. No, sorry, that's it. These are assumptions, he says, these are assumptions that historians are unable to verify or investigate, which cannot be assumed as sound premises in historical analysis. Okay, that's what he says. He says the same applies to the resurrection of Jesus. In order to justify the particular claim that Jesus is resurrected, one has to assume a slew, whatever that means, a lot of untestable metaphysical assumptions about miracles, divine wills, and other unproven phenomena that cannot be regarded as bona fide historical background knowledge. I think this is all merely an attempt to update Hume's argument against miracles. So this is the guy we blame for it originally. And yeah, he says, no miracle in history is attested by a sufficient number of educated and honest men. Well, we could argue with that one for a start. People crave the miraculous and will believe the most absurd stories. Well, that's probably true. Miracles only occur among barbarous peoples. There's some Western Enlightenment intellectual snobbery if ever I saw one. And then this one's incredible. Miracles occur in all religions, and since different religions contradict each other, they must cancel each other out. We may laugh at this as an argument, but actually, it carried a lot of influence. Well, I think it still carries influence today. It's just dressed up in fancier terms. But we need to be aware of how people are attempting to undermine the argument. I would say that actually the cognitive dissonance reduction is actually, the more I thought about it, I thought it's still in play today. It's exactly what people are using when confronted with what is, in fact, and I don't think we'll actually understand the resurrection till we grasp the fact that it is scandalous, it is completely unexpected, it's not something we can easily get our heads around. And that's, I think, why so many Western philosophers, and even in Jesus' time, people are trying to find other explanations for it. It doesn't fit with other world views. And so there's a cognitive dissonance reduction actually working the other way here. People are trying to come up with many explanations which introduce all sorts of ad hoc assumptions in order to deny the plain and simple fact that God raised Jesus from the dead.